I would just say I'm not used to that work.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of the School of Celtic Studies research podcast, Nianza, where I, Nike, the podcasting O'Donovan scholar, talk to Michal Hoyne, who is our Bergen fellow. We discuss why cows look zen, or perhaps confused, whether swans have knees, and we consider starting our own merch range. And, oh yeah, of course, we also discuss a lot of bardic poetry. We hope you enjoy! Our second episode of the SES research podcast, Nianza, we have with us Michal Hoyne, who is a Bergen fellow at the Institute, and who is aware that I'll be throwing Old Irish questions at him today. I hope. Yeah, you're good.
It's too late now.
Yeah, exactly. You're being recorded, so you can't escape now. So I'll throw the first question your way, which is an easy one to get us started. So the first question is, Kesht, kia the hof on them shifain, agus kith the tukon shin. What is your name and what brought you here? So, Michal, go for it.
Well, my name is, as you said, Michal Hoyne. I was brought to this podcast by the invitation of a colleague and by your nefarious intervention in my life. How far back would you like me to go in answering the question?
That's actually an interesting answer to this question, because what I kind of intended was what brought you to, you know, to us at the Institute. But indeed, as our listeners, if you haven't listened to the previous episode, you might not know that we have a system of rotation in place where the podcaster or the interviewee gets to nominate the next guest. So Michal has the pleasure of having been nominated by our previous guest, Christina Cleary. So he couldn't say no, to come on. But so what brought you to, I suppose, do Celtic studies or to the Institute?
Yeah, well, I suppose, I mean, going very, very far back, for whatever reason, I think I have always had an interest in the Irish language as a kid. You know, I read translations by Lady Gregory and so on.
Oh, lovely.
And you won't find her on many bibliographies these days. But, you know, she's still a great recruiting sergeant.
Definitely. And, would you be able to explain who she was for anyone who might not know her?
God, you're really putting me on the spot now. I'm far more into the classical. Well, Lady Gregory, I suppose, was a major figure in the Celtic Renaissance, I think we call it. Mm. I suppose late 19th, early 20th century, a renewed interest in Ireland's past and efforts to, I suppose, support the cultural nationalist cause. And she translated things like, you know, stories about Cuchulainn and so on into English. You know, very romantic and, you know, a little bit, I suppose, mawkish nowadays. But, you know, still some of them are still, you know, wonderful works of literature and still very interesting and give, you know, for a lot of people are a way into our field. My father was always very interested in politics. He's a publican. My mother had a real interest in the Irish language. She's a nurse. I wasn't particularly good at Irish at school.
That's interesting to know for any listeners who might, you know, feel a bit of trepidation at the mention of the Irish language.
I think one of the things, if there's anything about me that is good as a researcher, I think part of the reason is that I'm often quite slow at getting things, which means you have to work that bit harder and look for the rules and look for the shortcuts. And out of such stuff, grammarians and philologists are made. You know?
Yes, that's actually a very good point. I always feel the same about doing research.
So in secondary school, anyway, I began really to take an interest, and I found the Irish language curriculum, which we had to do for the junior cert and the leaving cert, just absolutely boring, tedious. And the only thing that really got me going, I was very lucky to have a wonderful teacher, Pat O'Sullivan, St. Vincent's College in Stillorgan.
Shout out.
And he was just one of those fantastic teachers. He was prepared to keep students after class who wanted to read outside of the curriculum. He introduced us to, you know, real juicy poetry. And he also let me know that there was this early modern Irish thing out there, you know, that there there was Keating and Bardic poetry. And there was a tiny part of the Leaving Cert that was devoted to the history of the language. And you only had to learn off more or less, you know, a few lines about what is, you know, Bardic poetry or what is Om or things like that.
Right.
But it was enough anyway that I got interested, and I never really, I don't remember deciding. I knew I was going to do Irish and history, modern Irish and history.
Right.
At Trinity, and I went on and started in Trinity. And
you never left.
Well, more or less, yeah. Well, I had to go to Germany. It made Trinity rather difficult. But
there's definitely some interesting lines here, because Christina was telling us last time that she too went to Germany, following in the footsteps of the great Damien McManus, as it were, thinking the only way I get to continue in Celtic studies is to also go to Germany. Which might come as a surprise to people who are not part of the field, but Germany, of course, is a very it's actually one of the founding stones, I suppose, of the field, as it were.
And you know, it's a wonderful, you know, one of the things that people do underestimate about Irish studies, Irish philology, or Celtic studies more generally, is that it is, you know, European and international. Mm-hmm. I went to Germany a bit later than Christina did, or at a later stage in her career. I went actually after I'd done my PhD. Right. My first job was in Germany. I was very nervous applying for it. They wanted an early modern Irish specialist, mm-hmm. but I didn't have any German at that time. And I thought, well, what better way to learn than to go if they'll put up with me for a few months while I'm learning? And they did, and they were very good and very generous. I too went to Marburg, a beautiful place, lovely department, wonderful colleagues. And I was lucky enough to get the job, but as I discovered late in the day, I was the only applicant for the job.
Oh, were you?
So, however proud I felt of myself for getting it the early days, it wasn't deserved.
I'm sure it was deserved anyway. But is that an illustration of the fact that a lot of interest in the field of Celtic studies has gone to, I suppose, the medieval period as opposed to the later medieval and early modern period? Or was that just a weird accident, you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think in general, early modern Irish is, despite a current renaissance and despite a lot of people being interested in it, and indeed, you know, brilliant work going back many decades, it is underdeveloped. You know, there's an awful lot of work that needs to be done still. I think early modern Irish, a little bit, I suppose, like Middle Irish, is often treated as ancillary, you know. It's something that you can either attack as an early Irish scholar, you'll muddle your way through early modern Irish, or if you have a good grounding in modern Irish, you can sort of go backwards and this synthetic form is a bit unusual, but quickly find your feet. And I think it struggles a little bit perhaps in not having a strong enough profile on its own. Mm-hmm. I do think that is changing. I think there's more appreciation now for early modern Irish as its own field. But yeah, certainly on the continent, I think perhaps because you're taking a bigger span. Generally, you know, in Ireland, we can afford to have departments of modern Irish and departments of early Irish, whereas in Marburg, you're doing not only Celtic, you know, but you can throw in, you know, Indo-European and so on. And that tends to mean, you know, that you're going back to the earlier stages of the language, because they're, you know, it's a principle of comparative historical linguistics. So on, you go back to the earliest stage to try and compare languages and so on. But on the other hand, I like that early modern Irish, silly, you know, it sounds, you know, Middle Irish is, if you like, the middle child, but in some ways, actually, early modern Irish, I do feel, is the middle child. You know, there's an enormous amount of continuity from old and middle Irish literature, say, you know, syllabic poetry, for example, stretching from the old Irish period down to the end of the early modern Irish period. And for that reason, you know, the early modern Irish scholar really does need to know about early Irish and needs to be up to date on what's happening in early Irish. But linguistically, you know, we are comfortable with that watershed between early and modern, and it does belong, you know, on the modern side linguistically. But I, you know, early modern Irish is a good kind of base to have if you want to explore the earlier period and the modern period.
Yes, yeah. And of course, many of the scribes who copied these early texts for us were from that period. So
I suppose we
sometimes forget that. And that's an important part of it as well.
I do feel a lot of early Irish scholars forget, if you like, that early modern transmission.
Yes.
And sometimes it's nice, I think, for them to have an early modernist in the room to go, no, that's not particularly significant. That's perfectly ordinary early modern spelling. It does not point to a 6th century date for this text or something like that.
I hear you like you're liking your role as party pooper. Is that it? You're the early Irish party pooper. But I do feel, I'm surprised to hear that there was actually some thought given to this in secondary school when you were learning Irish. So there was some early modern Irish in the curriculum.
Well, there was really only this tiny, I can't remember now even what percentage of the overall mark for Irish you got for Stair na Gaeilge. And that's just the name of the course, not the name of the spider killer that we all have on our desks. But
just to explain, there's a really big book and it's called Stair na Gaeilge, and it has the grammar of the whole of Irish in it, which means it's a great spider killer because it's really big.
Not that we should be killing spiders, of course.
Of course,
The Dublin Institute wishes to distance itself from these arachnophobic comments.
Biodiversity is important. Okay. But anyway.
But no, there was only a tiny sliver, you know, and it was really just through, as I say, an interested and engaged and enthusiastic teacher that I started reading this stuff and hunting it out. And then when I went into Trinity as junior fresh 2006, I was really chomping at the bit, and the professor there was warned in advance by one of the other lecturers.
Oh, no way.
There's this guy Hoyne in first year who wants to know about bardic poetry. He has a real interest. And Professor McManus is alleged to have responded, "Don't worry, we'll cure that quickly."
That's the classic McManus right there.
Do you know, I was so, you know, it's so lucky in a way. I mean, I'm speaking obviously very selfishly, you know. I was sitting in the class with maybe 25 or 30 other people. I'm the only one who went on to study Irish at third level. But I'm so glad it was there, you know, and you do wonder what course would your life have taken if you hadn't had these, if not exactly chance, at least fortuitous encounters with things like that. And but, you know, then I still remember very, very vividly sitting in a lecture hall in the awful arts block of Trinity College, which you know very well.
Ah, yes.
Disgusting building. But sitting there and the first poem that we did and just feeling this is interesting stuff. And I think, you know, I was always attracted to the classical modern Irish, the sort of bardic stuff, because it's very difficult, but it's very rewarding, you know.
Yes.
I think, you know, I was the first in my family to go to college, and I think I was aware that, you know, the taxpayer, hardworking nurses and bus drivers are paying my fees. So I thought, well, this is great. I really love doing bardic poetry, but it's bloody hard. You know, the taxpayer is getting value for his or her money.
Very true. Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we had, again, you know, great lecturers who had that ability to sort of face the difficulty head on, you know, not to pretend that it is easy, because anybody who starts investigating medieval, early modern art and so on very quickly discovers it's not actually easy. It can be great fun, but it's not necessarily easy. But it, you know, I think if you have a good teacher, they can, on the one hand, you know, make it accessible, make it exciting, make you want to persevere, but at the same time leave open that door for maybe more advanced students to say, oh, this is challenging, I can go further with this, I can take this to another level than just, you know, passing this exam or writing this essay or whatever it might be.
Yeah, teachers are definitely very important for any career, I think. I think all of us are able to pinpoint, you know, the teacher that made him think, oh,
yeah, or unfortunately, sometimes the teacher that turns you on something forever.
That is true as well, but let's not get into this. This is a very positive podcast.
Indeed.
Except for poor spiders, but
they deserve it.
Oh, hey, I thought we agreed on no arachnophobic comments. But any case, now you're at the School of Celtic Studies at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, and you're our very own Bergen Fella. So what is that? What does that mean? And why is it called the Bergen Fellowship?
That's a good question. I think the Dublin Institute has O'Donovan scholarships, which are generally now for people just after finishing their PhD, maybe, or, you know, very early in their career. And then Bergen Fellowships for slightly more senior academics, but, you know, I do say slightly more senior, you know, still very much early career researchers. The names, I suppose, as you know, the O'Donovan Scholarship, of course, honours John O'Donovan, one of the great pioneers, philologists and antiquarians of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And Bergen is widely credited by many with being one of the founders of the scientific study of the Irish language, of bringing rigorous German philology to Ireland, the beginning of the 20th century. By the way, these scholarships all had far less romantic names until, I think, a few decades ago.
Oh, really? I did not know that, actually.
I'm trying to remember the exact terms, but I think junior research assistant might have been the old name for the Bergen Fellowship. I'd much rather be a fellow, yes.
Yes. And I do like the ring of the O'Donovan Scholarship as well, because both myself and Christina, our previous guest, are on the O'Donovan Scholarship, and we're very proud to throw that name around at parties where you're introduced and you're like, I am the O'Donovan Scholar, which sounds much better. Yeah.
And it really means something, you know, in our field. You know, the Institute is, again, a really storied place. That, you know, I used to come to seminars here when I was a PhD student. And I mean, you'd be nervous going in, you know, and seeing these titans of scholarship battle it out and really tease over text. And you know, it's a even when I was in Germany in my first job after the PhD, you know, Hittite scholars and scholars of Indo-European and so on would say to me, "An O'Donovan scholarship." But that's very prestigious, isn't it? The implication being, of course, why the hell did they give it to you?
But the surprise is a bit disconcerting.
But, you know, it's a sign of the real prestige that comes from it. So. The Bergen Fellowship is a wonderful chance. 5 years of research time in really the sort of beating heart or throbbing brain of Celtic studies. Wonderful research library, seminars, colleagues to discuss things with.
Yes.
And I mean, it is very similar to the O'Donovan Scholarship, just 2 years longer.
Yes.
and of course, the title bump.
Exactly. Yeah. So your project is 5 years. What is your project? What will you be looking at during these 5 years? Yeah, well, I know you're heading towards the end of your 5 years, so you'd be able to give us some sort of summary, I hope. No pressure.
I was warned to keep this fun and interesting, so bear with me. Bear with me, dear listener. I'm about to say things like Irish grammatical tracts, but trust me, it's all very exciting.
Well, Christina said parsing last week, so I think we're good.
Hopefully not before the watershed. So I am working on re-editing and analysing a text that is given the very romantic name, Irish Grammatical Tracts 3-4.
Oh, love
and
it.
I mean, it just trips off the tongue. But there were a series of texts put together probably towards the end of the 15th century, the beginning of the 16th century, that really do represent something quite unique in vernacular Western European linguistics. Mm. A lot of languages in the early 16th century, European languages, were getting their first grammars, or were getting their first dictionaries, were becoming objects of serious study. Irish, of course, had already been doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a native grammatical tradition stretching back to the Old Irish period, growing out of Latin, of course, but by the time you get to the later medieval, early modern Irish grammatical tracts, it's a fully fledged system in its own right. You know, it requires separate study. And these tracts were put together specifically to describe the type of language used in syllabic poetry, high prestige, professional praise poetry, very much the creme de la creme of literary production. Professional, learned men writing for secular patrons, the lords, the ladies, the chieftains and so on, mm-hmm. of later medieval and early modern Ireland. And they did something really quite extraordinary. They developed or I suppose participated in some way in the evolution of a canon. We estimate it's about 1,200 poems that they had as a database. Wow.
That is enormous, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, if you think nowadays, for bardic poetry nowadays, we have 2,000 poems extant, right? Now, that is probably the tiniest fraction of what must once have been written between the 13th century and the 17th century. But this is what we have. But we've estimated that these bardic grammarians, these scholars, formed this database, or perhaps, you know, it formed more gradually as a sort of exercise in canon formation, you know. But these were the master poets of the 13th and the 14th and the 15th centuries, early 16th as well. And they studied them and they described the language that they used, and they described it in enormous detail. They described the things that they liked and the things that they disliked. And they set out in these grammatical tracts their own system, their own understanding of how the language worked. So from the from this sort of exercise in grammar writing, if you like, we got these big juicy tracts. IGT 2, say, which deals with the noun and the adjective, has 207 sections. Now the different manuscripts are slightly different, so but 207 sections to get every little complication, every little nuance of how to decline a noun in classical modern Irish. The things
I like how you call that juicy.
Oh yeah, but it really is. If you think now, if you in the 17th century, the Franciscans on the continent first forced, if you like, the five declension system of Latin onto Irish, and that's still what you learn if you do the declensions in school. You learn this five declension system, which is completely inadequate for all the intricacies of the Irish language. You know, it took, as I say, 207 paragraphs, 207 little declensions, if you like, to really get all these wonderful complications across. And bearing in mind, you're dealing with the stage of the language where you don't have a standardized orthography. So things can go wrong. And you're not, you don't have a printing press. You know, you don't, people aren't mass producing, photocopying, let alone you know, putting things up online. So they came up with, or again, perhaps it gradually developed, it might not necessarily have been one individual overnight, but a system of being, if you like, foolproof. How do we make sure that the teaching is correct? So they took examples from this corpus that they had created, these master poets that they studied in bardic schools, and they picked metrically fixed examples of everything that they wanted to show. So if you were concerned with showing the correct declension of a noun, say, all you have to do is get an example where the meter fixes it. And classical modern Irish meter is very, very complicated, very sophisticated. So you have that example there. And that way, even if I, as a careless scribe, if I've had a bit too much to drink, or I'm arguing with my wife, or it's dark and cold and all the other things that scribes complain about, I can still reconstruct what it should have been, you know. And it's a wonderfully advanced methodology. And in many ways, actually, those of us who are modern research will recognize it. In my youth, Nika, in the long ago.
Michal is here pretending he's a lot older than me, which in fact he is not. So, but it's one of his topoi, so I'll give it to him.
In the long ago, we used to say,
Fado.
Picks or it didn't happen, i.e. photographic evidence or it's not real. And modern Irish philologists often joke, rhyming examples or it's not real. It is still, you know, the gold standard, because we don't have recordings, you know, we can't hop into a time machine, we can't do fieldwork. So metrically fixed examples of a particular linguistic feature are the gold standard of evidence. And that's what our predecessors in the, say, well, let's say the 15th and 16th century, that's what they were doing too.
I feel we should have merch for the this podcast where we have t-shirts with metrical fixed examples or it didn't happen.
It's an idea.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many of them would sell, but They would have at least the two of us, you know.
In Dutch, we'd say they'd sell like warm buns. I'm sure they'd be gone without it.
I think hotcakes. All right. Say, okay. In English or in American English, anyway.
Yes.
So anyway, that's the background, and you know, it really is a remarkable. The 16th century, as I say, all across Europe, you're seeing debates about language. Say in England, you're having debates about, you know, are there too many foreign words or too many words from, say, Greek or Latin? Mm. Should we be getting back to good Anglo-Saxon vocabulary? Mm. You're having, say, the first grammar of French is written, you know, the first grammar of actual, you know, vernacular French, not, you know, dealing with, if you like, as a deviation from Latin. This sort of stuff is happening all over Europe. And in Ireland, even though we had a much longer vernacular linguistic tradition, it reaches a new height with these tracts. Mm. And, you know, they discuss, you know, We've no doubt lost a great deal again, but, you know, very detailed tracts discussing, as I said, nominal declension or syntax, and meter, of course, is very important because these are the textbooks of bardic schools, of professionals. Yeah. So the one that I'm particularly interested in, and the one that I am trying to re-edit and then translate into English and give a commentary for and sort of make accessible, mm-hmm. Not only to scholars of Irish, but also to people who are interested in vernacular linguistics in Europe in this period, is one that is, and even trying to explain what it's about is actually a nice example of the difficulty of dealing with these texts and of a grammatical system that has its roots in Latin grammar but has been growing for a very long time. Mm-hmm. So it is a tract that deals with verbal nouns, mm-hmm. the verb more generally, and nouns derived from adjectives.
Juicy indeed.
And you're wondering to yourself, you're sitting at home and you're wondering, why in the hell are all of these brought together under one tract? Mm-hmm. And you really have to put yourself in the shoes of bardic grammarians and try and understand their terminology. The word persona in Latin was borrowed into Old Irish as person, mm-hmm. and gradually it became persa, and parsa in early modern Irish. And you might think as a grammatical term that that should mean person, you know, first person, second person, so on. Well, you'd be wrong by the time you get to the 16th century.
Sorry, listeners.
It now means, having taken lots of twists and turns, it now means abstract noun.
Oh.
And bardic poets believed that all verbal forms were actually derived from verbal nouns. So I do, you do, he does, and so on. They would say, well, that they're all derived from doing. That's the way they look at their grammar, and that's how they think it works. Now, a verbal noun is an abstract noun. You can't touch it, you can't eat it, you can't smell it, you can't, you know. So with that in mind, right, they think that all verbal forms are derived from verbal nouns. All verbal nouns are abstract nouns. It makes sense that they group all these different things together in one big, massive tract, because it's all united by their understanding of parsa, the grammatical concept of parsa, which doesn't really translate into English, you know.
Yes.
And it's a nice example of part of the joy of working on these tracts.
It's very elegant and very advanced, as you say.
Yeah.
And I must say, like, my next question would have been... why would you be doing that, you poor thing? But I think you kind of answered that as well, and we can throw that question in the bin, because it seems like an incredibly advanced system of dealing with the grammar of your language, and also, I suppose, in passing on that knowledge to students and other generations of poets and linguists.
We are extraordinarily lucky to have them, both as an insight into their own grammatical thought. Here you have incredibly learned native speakers telling us what they thought about their language, when they believed a word had two different senses or simply one sense, mm-hmm. when they believed a verb, the different, say, suppletive forms of a verb should be treated separately, or when they should be treated along with the rest of the verbal forms. You also have, you know, it is a remarkable repository of interesting forums, as the great Tipperary scholar Emma O'Brien was apparently wont to say. In fact, you know, when we investigate medieval or early modern Irish literature, you know, we're often very lucky. You know, we find rare words, we find rare verbal forms, but often, you know, there are gaps in the dictionary, there are gaps in our paradigms, just because we don't have the evidence. We weren't lucky enough to have the second singular of that verb. But the wonderful thing about these tracts is, you know, they give us an enormous amount of information we simply wouldn't have about rare items of vocabulary, full declensions of verbs where, you know, we simply, if we were left to our own devices, left to look at the text that we have surviving in manuscript, we might never be able to recover some of this information. Yeah. The third thing I would mention, just to really finish off that question.
Yeah, go for it.
Is just as literature. You know, I mentioned before that they have this, they had this database that they kept drawing on. These were master poets because they, you know, they really knew how to use the meter, because they were respected authorities on language, but also because they were bloody good poets. They filled these tracts with citations to prove the different teaching. And these citations are taken from some of the best, the most beautiful poems that we have extant in Irish. And indeed, some of them aren't extant anymore. We only know about them because we have these little extracts. You know, we've only actually identified about, I think it's an eighth of all of the citations.
That little, right?
So an awful, like an enormous amount of loss. And those poems were the ones that were really assiduously studied in schools. So the fact that we've lost them really does show how much material we've lost. But some of those lines are just so moving. You know, they really knock your socks off as you're going through the tract, you know. There's one of my favourites, actually, which I was talking to a colleague about the other day. An veird nor helig green da grieve na queer yerig near um noin. This is introduced, you know, just to illustrate a grammatical point, right?
Right.
So it's a beautiful metaphor about the sun going down at night. It's, you know, all that the sun does not cast away of its spears. So all the spears that the sun does not cast away during the day are a burning red mass from the west at night.
Oh, wow.
This idea that, you know, sunbeams, the word in Irish is gach, you know, they're spears.
Yes.
So you imagine the sun as having this arsenal of spears, and at the end of the day, as it's glowing red, they're all the spears it didn't cast during the day. You know, that's incredibly
that's beautiful imagery.
Beautiful image. Some are, you know, wonderful just for the, I suppose, the humanity of them, or even the just the artistry of them. Again, a poem that we haven't found the full poem. We only have these lines. I am angry at the king who gave, because he has taken from us the one that he gave. Two different forms of Irish there for gave, but giving out to God for taking away the person that he gave to you, you know. I'm angry at the king who gave because he took from us he whom he gave, you know. It's wonderful play in Irish, two different forms of the he gave, all wrapped up in one quatrain,
which is very poignant.
It is, and a lot
and
of
human,
you know,
as you say, like very
And indeed, actually, you would really love to know. I mean, a lot of bardic poems are formal, they're propaganda, or if you like, diplomacy by verse, you know. But we do have personal poems, poems of grief, poems where poets lament each other, for example, and speak very movingly about the death of a brother poet, say. And again, from the tracts, there's one example that is, again, we don't know, we don't have the full poem it's from, but nus ni tra trudje rin ska vidje ni ilim. Now is not the time to fight for me, or to fight with me, I should say. I am not under the protection of my teacher. And we can imagine or assume that that's a poem written on a teacher's death, you know. I don't have, or well, I mean, perhaps not, you know. Again, this is the difficulty with trying to, it could just be a poet who's going, a trainee poet who's, you know, gotten into an argument and his teacher's off in the pub. I don't know.
I know we young scholars, especially during your PhD, you do feel like that when you go to your first conference.
Indeed. Yes, that's it. And now, see, now you have your protection. And nus ni tra tride rin ska vidje ni ilim.
Yes,
That's your line to protect
yourself.
So
if there's any young scholars listening, use this line if you're ever under fire at a conference from very difficult question and your supervisor is not in a room.
Or if you ever want to illustrate one of the alternative genitive singulars of the word trid.
But or that's that, I mean, it happens to all of us.
Which is why it's cited in the tract. You know, tride rhymes with idje, and it, you know, gives you this perfect evidence that that is indeed a permissible form of the genitive of that word.
But it must be very difficult. I mean, in these lines, you can interpret it somehow, but it must be very difficult to sometimes to interpret these lines as there's no poem to go with it.
It is very difficult. I mean, one of the I suppose advantages of the tracts is it does seem that they selected quatrains and half quatrains, the most part anyway, that could stand alone, you know. Now, admittedly, there are times where you don't know. For example, if you're dealing with a third singular verb, there's no pronoun. Is it he, she, it? You know, and you do have to do a certain amount of guesswork. This is probably part of the reason why Osborne Bergen, who did a lot of the pioneering editing work on these tracts, chose not to translate these half quatrains. Another scholar working at the same time who similarly did, you know, Herculean work on the grammatical tracts, Lambert McKenna, he did translate them. And, you know, for most of them, you can at least make, you can at least make a guess, you know. And I do think, you know, many of them, you know, they deserve, you know, to be praised as literature. And I think we should attempt a translation. You know, translations are always tentative, you know. And indeed, if you have full text, they're often tentative. You know, another manuscript might alter how you might have taken a particular sentence or so on. So, you know, I think in something like this, you know, you try and be brave and you give it your best attempt.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. And it's very interesting to see sort of, because this links in nicely with the previous episode as well, where Christina was telling us that a lot of the, a lot of poetry quatrains and phrases and whatnot are only preserved because they were used in a commentary. For example, the commentary to the Avra Kolmchille or the commentary to the Feilere Eingesse. And we have all these tantalizing snippets of text that are now lost. And it's the same for the Bardic grammatical tracts
and indeed the earlier grammatical tracts as well, or metrical tracts, you know, Mittelirische Verslehren. We don't actually have, say, a lot of satire from the early modern period. You know, we have a few examples, but if you read through the grammatical tracts, there are quite a few nasty quatrains giving out about the table manners of some O'Kelly women, or saying that some fella looks like an owl, which was meant as an insult, you know. And
I think it's rather cute, but
that's it. I mean, I've certainly been called worse, but
I think this is a good moment, sorry, for a plug as well, because, you know, the Institute does actually sell a book on early Irish satire, where Roisin McLaughlin, I think, has collected all these satire quatrains in one book, and it's great reading. And you and me, actually, last year for Culture Night, we did a little workshop on composing a satire, which had some great results, I must say.
It was great fun. It was great fun. It's funny, it seems to be natural to everyone, you know, to understand the principles. But I really would thoroughly recommend Roisin's book, because it makes for, again, fantastic reading. And, you know, you'll learn how to insult somebody, say they're like badger's poo and that sort of thing, you know.
Exactly. And do it in Old Irish as well, so you're safe, because not a lot of people would actually know what you're saying.
So. But also, you know, so many insults that we use in day-to-day life are so boring, you know. You you know, spice it up, you know.
Exactly. And on that note, I know you yourself also have a book out at the Institute.
I do.
Was that a previous project of yours? Or
It was indeed. Well, it's an expanded version of my PhD thesis.
All right. So, do you know, what is the title of your book, just to, so people can find it on our website?
It's Fuil Oir, that is the survivors, those who have made it out of the battle. Bardic poems on the Mec Irmada of Mo Lurug. So it's a study of the small little kingdom of North Roscommon, Mo Lurug, was ruled by the MacDermots in the Middle Ages. They were great patrons of poetry. In the book, I tried to edit as best as I could those poems that hadn't been edited in honour of that family before, and as well as that, to kind of provide a bit of context and a sort of a study of the overall corpus. So yes, I understand it is available on the website of the Institute.
And it's also very big, so, you know, if you dislike your spiders.
It's plenty to read, but it's actually, it's a wonderful, you know, again, I've mentioned before, you know, I was already interested in Bardic poetry coming, I was already converted, if you like, before I went to Trinity, and I had a great time as an undergraduate. I studied history, medieval history, with Catherine Sims, who did extraordinary work in teaching historians and indeed philologists to read Bardic poetry. Yes. She created the Bardic Poetry Database. I was lucky enough too to be taught by Damon McManus and Owen McCorha, two of the foremost scholars of Bardic poetry. And not only that, but even as an undergrad, they were prepared to let me edit a poem from manuscript. I had my first experience of editing, you know, something that no one else had done, no one else had translated.
That is such exciting work to do.
And to go on and do the PhD, it really was fun. And, you know, Bardic poetry has a sort of, in some ways, a bad reputation because, you know, the meter and the language are so complicated, it requires that extra level of study. But it really is great fun. In that McDermott book, you know, you have... you know, wonderful martial poems, you know, really macho stuff, all these, you know, lads heading off to steal cows and slash each other's legs off and that sort of thing, you know, gruesome, awful. But you have wonderful apologues, you know, Cuchulainn defending Ulster, looking down at his chest and realizing for the first time that he's human. And then uttering beautiful lines, which I often say to students to remind them to be gentle with themselves. You know, ve dem chria dol no del dosid an their cuach lasri, fa chlor srav glas namach mean la an yarnas ni yinginen. Had I known, had I thought that my heart was of flesh and blood, I would not have done half of what I did around the plain of green streams and musical bees, sweet-sounding bees, you know. He realizes, you know, he believed he was made of iron or made of stone. Yeah. So yes, it's a fantastic history. And you get wonderful insights into society as well. One of the poems I edited in the McDermott book has an eyewitness account of, there was a movement in the 15th century, patrons, in particular aristocrats, actually were in some ways stricter than the priests and nuns that they supported. And particularly in the 15th century, they began to get annoyed that priests were, you know, engaging in relationships which were not appropriate, given their oath of celibacy. Mm-hmm. And there's actually an eyewitness account in the McDermott book of a priest trying to seduce a nun, and the poet records it and disputes the priest had sworn on the great missal that he hadn't made any attempt, and she was an anchoress too, meaning she was, ooh, you know, mured, she was trapped in this little, you know, little room beside the church as in a sort of an ascetic practice.
He set himself quite the job then.
Well, I presume she had a door to let him in or something. I mean, let's not go into, I don't know, maybe there was a little latch you could open. Let's not get into the, let's keep this PG now.
Yes, all right.
But you know, Bardic poetry is one of these wonderful things. You know, on the one hand, you do have to be, you know, a linguist, you have to be a student of metrics, you have to be a student of history. But, you know, it's full of so many interesting stories and apologues and metaphors. You find yourself, as a colleague of mine was recently, wondering, do swans have knees and where are they? Or having to, you know, research the life cycle of salmon because, you know, a poet has constructed a whole poem on the metaphor of the life cycle of a salmon, you know. It's wonderful. You know, it's wonderful exercise for the mind.
Yeah.
You know,
and very broad ranging. Very broad ranging by the sound of it. Yeah. And what's the deal with this cow stealing? Because we know, of course, that the Tombo Cuininge, I mean, the famous epic of the Irish, is about stealing cows. But then apparently, Bardic poets were describing people going about stealing cows still in the.
Oh, this is most of what they did for most of the medieval, early modern period. I mean, the annals are largely just records of McDermott went into O'Connor Sligo and took his cows, and O'Connor Sligo took them back, and then McDonagh decided he'd have some of them too. But you know, this is in a society where cattle were such an important role, a mark of status, you know. Practically, you know, a currency still.
Do you think that's why cows always have this sort of eternally confused look on their faces? Because they are always, you know, being transferred
between. I think it's very zen. I feel cows are just.
Okay, maybe that's it. They just don't care. It's like, okay, I'll go to your field, whatever.
That's it. Oh, yeah. Am I in McDermott territory today? All right. McDonagh territory. O'Connor Sligo. All right.
These cows got to see the world, man.
I mean, you do get other things. You know, there's the good old fashioned, you know, pillaging and burning.
Never. And stealing never horses. Goes out of fashion. All right. Yes.
You get the occasional stealing of a of a backgammon set. I'm not sure if that's even the right word. You know, there's a little bit of variety, but yes, it is. It is mostly horses and cows.
Yeah. We do also get the occasional book, which is kind of cool, that is used as ransom, for example, to buy some Earl's freedom. So, you know, as nerds, we appreciate that.
In absolutely.
Your value is a book. A very big book. Okay, excellent. Let's move on to the next question. Kesht. It is not from study that you have thought that up, which I kind of used to ask you about. Does life outside of academia inspire you? Is there anything in your daily life where you go, oh, I can use it in my research? Or is it because you can go on walks and then brilliant ideas come to you? Or is there anything outside of academia that inspires you?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, well, first of all, I mean, in general, as researchers, you know, it's very important because we are so in our heads, you know, and it is possible for us, in many cases anyway, to work from home and, if you like, never to take a break. I think it's a very important part of our research to not do research sometimes.
A very nice take on this.
You know, to just go outside and talk to somebody else, you know.
Yes.
I mean, I think the driving force for me in my research is my own curiosity, if you like. You know, there's no external impulse that leads me to research. I just think that the material that we are lucky enough to work on and that the taxpayer is generous enough to support is interesting part of European history. And, you know, we should do our duty to share it.
Yes.
It's funny, you know, all the different things, though, that do help you going about it. You know, as I said, when editing a bardic poem, you know, you never know. You could be staring at a swan in the river and suddenly you understand a metaphor, you know.
Yes. Yeah, did you see the knees? Are there knees?
Exactly. There are knees.
Oh, wow. Giant newsflash here in this podcast. You heard it here first. Swans
this is,
have
by the
knees.
Way, in case you're wondering, you know, why you would want such a thing, bardic poets often use these extravagant metaphors to describe, you know, the excellent weather and the fertility of the land under the rule of the just lord and sometimes lady. And, one of the things that they will say, for example, is that because the sun is shining so much, the water level goes down, you know, so you actually get a mini drought. They don't mind talking about droughts, actually. That's regarded as a good thing. I suppose in Ireland it was so unrealistic among the time. But they'll say, you know, the water doesn't reach a swan's knees. You know?
Oh, right, yeah.
Best check where the knees are on the swan, I suppose.
Very good, yeah.
But no, I do think, I mean, you know, I was talking before about, you know, the humanity of a lot of this literature. And I think, you know, it's important for us, you know, not to exist in too rarefied an atmosphere, because it is human beings who produced the literature that we work on. And very often they're about human affairs, you know, and even the most supernatural and, you know, magical and legendary stories will often have just the basic human reality of it, you know, emotions, jealousy or grief or whatever it might be. And, you know, I think it is important just to be out, to be listening to people, to be, you know, out in the world. But, you know, on the other hand, it is also another, you know, the past is a different country and things are different there, you know. And say with bardic poetry, you know, you're working on stuff produced for the 1% of society, if you like, you know. Celebrating war, celebrating violence, you know, celebrating these martial ideals that certainly I don't admire very much. So, you know, it's also very strange from us in lots of ways.
You mentioned the occasional reference to women in these poems. Do we know of any bardic poems that were written by women, and what type of stuff would be written about women? Do we know anything about that?
The issue of sort of female poets, at least in the later medieval and early modern Irish period, is very controversial. We have a handful of poems that might be written by women, but of a sort of an informal nature, if you like. You know, actual formal bardic panegyric, the sort of stuff that patrons wanted to put in their poem books and the manuscripts that they paid for, these were written by men. It was a male profession. We have no evidence of sort of women receiving any kind of training. There is a list of poets that was put together in, I think, 1585 in Munster. by the English authorities, and it's kept in the Lambeth Library.
Right.
There are several hundred poets on there. Interestingly, it also mentions a number that the kind of poet we would be familiar with, whose work tends to be preserved in manuscripts, is a Philla. Okay?
Yes.
That's a high-ranking, literate, well-educated, prestigious sort of person. You know, there were also poets known as the Bard, you know, Bard in the singular, and their work, at least in Ireland anyway, doesn't tend to survive. It doesn't tend to make it into manuscripts. Now, in this list, you have, I think, several hundred names of men, but you do have two women named as she-bards,
okay.
And that's the term used, she-bards. So it implies, at least, you know, there were at least a tiny minority of women who, if you like, broke the glass ceiling. but at the lower level rather than at the higher level, I don't think we have any evidence.